Sunrose Yoga. Reveal and remember your sacred nature through the practice of yoga. The Sunrose Yoga Podcast is a collection of audio recordings, videos, and writings about the practices of yoga. The podcast's mission is to share the teachings of yoga in an accessible way and to foster meaningful discussion about the practices. To learn more or to experience past teachings, please visit sunroseyoga.com. The Sunrose Yoga Podcast is made possible by the generous donations of students and supporters. If you find this podcast useful or beneficial, please consider making a secure online donation by clicking the donate button at sunroseyoga.com. And thanks.
Beloveds, thank you so much for joining me for episode 113 of the Sunrose Yoga Podcast. In today's episode, we're listening to the second half of my interview with Sarah Treelease. For part one of this delightful interview, go to sunroseyoga.com and listen to episode 112. Sarah has been teaching yoga, workshops, trainings, retreats, and classes around the world since 1999. With Renee Sills, whom you might remember from episode 109 of the Sunrose Yoga Podcast, Sarah is the co-director of SOLA School for the Contemplative Arts, which holds trainings in contemplative embodied practices for yoga students and teachers in Portland, Oregon. Thank you so much for being here. Learn more about Sarah at sunroseyoga.com. Thank you.
So you and Renee are going to, you're running your program again next year.
Uh-huh.
What are your plans for this Zen chaplaincy?
I don't know.
That you've done.
My desire right now, so I was thinking, so the program was a pre-chaplaincy program, and if mm-hmm. I become a chaplain, that's like a good 3-year program to get, mm-hmm. well, to get a divinity degree, mm-hmm. chaplaincy, but even chaplaincy itself can take 3 to 5 years. I love my Zen teachers in New York. It's not workable to me to go back and mm-hmm. forth. I don't right now, for the time being, want to be in a long distance program that way. So, what I know that I would really like, which I've kind of wanted for years to do, is to get a master's degree in Buddhist studies. Mm-hmm. And my trepa is Tibetan, mm-hmm. and that, you know, Tibetan is where I started, and my trepa is right here in town, and they do master's programs, and you can get a master's degree in Buddhist studies with a focus on practice. Which I can't think of anything more wonderful, and like what I could use in my life is to get a master's degree in meditating. You know, I mean, like obviously it's ridiculous to say that, but in other words, to be required to do deep meditation and practice. Mm-hmm. And so I would really like to do that, and maybe there's a possibility that I would then keep going and turn that into a divinity degree. I think I'm pastoral in my. I know that I'm pastoral, mm-hmm. and yet I could see myself becoming a chaplain, but I don't think that that's just yet because I think I'm a teacher. I mean, I know I'm a teacher.
Mm-hmm.
So right now, what's happening is we're developing this program, and the program is having all of these different. We're bringing other teachers in. We're really opening. We're developing our school as a school with an emphasis on collaboration and arts and contemplative art practices. And so I think that like starting that and seeing kind of where that goes and how we can as teachers and also as sort of the curators of this, bring people and invite people to explore like what it means to be human, mm-hmm. and how to be fully human, how to be fully human in our own ways, and to how as a teacher you work with people in a fully human way, and people, everybody's on a threshold, it's, you know, but working with thresholds, mm-hmm. you know? And so that I feel like is, I don't know what's going to happen, but that's going to, something's going to happen that's going to take me somewhere.
Yeah.
And then maybe within a year or something, maybe I'll think about, keep revisiting the notion of this.
Masters in meditation. So what's your daily practice like?
My daily practice is kind of, it shifts a lot. It really depends on where, you know, like where I am in my cycle. Mm-hmm. I would say that I have a constant practice of, or intentionality around self-awareness. And I'll usually have these bigger things I'm working on. Like the last 2 years ago, I started a year-long, I didn't know it would be a year, but it was a year-long, like I called it the anxiety project. And it was about observing my anxiety moment to moment and what my relationship was. And then that's kind of shifted and morphed into different specifics. And that's all been health related. Things arise. This has to change. What's going on? Why is this happening? How can I work with it in this way? Yeah. I have a meditation practice, which is, I would like to say it's daily, but it's depends on where I am in my cycle. When I've come out of a retreat, it's daily. When I'm when I'm not, you know, it's, it gets a little bit. And I would say the same thing about my yoga practice, which is I do something every day, and then some days it's a much longer sustained practice, and then I swim, and so swimming is also for me where I kind of spend time with myself. At different times I've been a runner, but some things, you know, my joints and things have shifted, and so I kind of have had to let that go for a little while.
Me too.
Yeah. You run for a long time.
A long time.
Yeah.
And every now and then I'll go back to it and I'll say, this is terrible.
Yeah.
I don't want to do this.
I do too, except that every now and again I do it and it's like, oh, this is wonderful.
Yeah.
Partly is that I'm like clinging to what used to be so wonderful about it that I love so well. It's been hard to...
I found something similar with my bike and almost more joyful. Because for me, the running and the years of it and the... It's connected somehow with a period of my life where, you know, I really wanted to control everything and do, you know, do my run, plan my life around running, you know, everything in its place. Everything on paper looks just hunky-dory.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
So there's a little bit of that for, I like...
Running has that quality of being sort of righteous.
Yes.
Just you saying that makes me think about that.
It's interesting.
Swimming is where I feel joy. And I really, really love it. Unfortunately, like running is the one thing you can do. Well, biking too, but running is the thing you can do where you can just go outside your house and do it.
Yeah.
Whereas swimming has to happen in some way. There's all sorts of inconveniences. You might forget your suit, or there might not be a lane, or you have to, you know. So and I miss New York because, A, in New York, you can just be going by all your places on foot or on your bike. Biking here is challenging for me because I don't like to be cold and wet. And I just got a bike that I love and it practically carries me up the hills. I just love it. But I don't really like hills. Like, I want to just amble. I want to amble and like look around. So that's my opinion.
You have to really be on it too.
You have to be doing it.
Yeah.
It's my husband's practice.
Yeah, I mean, biking is yoga because you have to, if you're not present, like, there are real consequences. Mm-hmm. And,
And so why did you come to Portland?
So I had lived here, I moved here with a boyfriend 14 years ago. Mm-hmm. And sort of between undergrad and what was next. And I thought I would leave and, you know, to go to law school after that year was over, but I didn't. And I stayed and I went to Lewis and Clark. Mm-hmm. And that's where I met my husband. You know, you move out here for, it's the story, like where you move a place for a guy and you're 20, so you break up. And, and then, so I finished school here and we decided, my husband, we weren't married then, but we decided to move to Colorado because our job prospects seemed easier there, which they were. We both, you know, took the bar, got jobs right away. Mm-hmm. And, I was not meant to be a lawyer. And I knew that.
Mm-hmm. What kind of law were you doing?
Well, I studied environmental law, mm-hmm. and I ended up doing environmental law, but for a while I worked as a prosecutor, and that's when I did my teacher training, was when I was in that world. And I knew, like, at the time, like, this is important work. I need to be doing it, but I know it's not, like, the end for me. And it was harsh.
Wow.
I mean,
God, it seems so intense.
It was really intense. And I, like, I thought on some level, I thought, like, I can learn how to be in this space and still be me and still be soft and me and compassionate and see, you know, like, defendants would come in and they would, you know, do things that brought them to, like, sometimes it was violent things, sometimes it was non-violent things, but, like, everybody has their story, how they got from point A to point B, and seeing that felt important. Like, I don't know if everyone sees that.
Yeah.
They just see, you know, the assault or the whatever.
Yeah.
And so it felt really important, but what I think can happen is, in order for you to keep doing that job, like, you have to harden in some way. Otherwise,
because you can't look at what brought them there to a large degree. It's just the thing they did.
Yeah. And it was,
that seems like it would be unbearable to me.
It was a good, I mean, it was important, and I'm glad I did it. Yeah. I don't think I could go back now, even though I'm much more rooted in my practice. And that's when I really, you know, that's been 10 years ago, and that's when I really started actually meditating and actually having a practice. Yeah. Even though, like, you know, I had dabbled. I had my Jon Kabat-Zinn books from when I was, like, 18 and carried them around and didn't know what to do with them.
Yeah, yeah,
but
yeah.
It wasn't until then that where I was like, oh, I'm not just reading about it, I'm sitting.
Yeah.
And that's when I was like, I cannot go on this way.
Yeah.
Like,
what was the teacher training you did? What kind of yoga were you?
So it's so interesting. Renee and I were in Colorado at the same time, and she was with Richard Freeman at his workshop in Boulder, and I was at the Shambhava school.
Oh.
They have three schools in Colorado, two ashrams, one outside of Boulder. Well, they're both sort of outside of Boulder. One's in up above Netherland. And I was studying for the most part at their school in Denver.
Shambhala, separate from Shambhala Center, or the
Shambhava?
Shambhava. Mm-hmm. So what is that?
So it's Kashmir Shaivism, Tantra. Mm. The lineage is sort of like Nityananda, Muktananda are are there as mm-hmm. as friends. Sri Shambhavananda, his teacher was this householder from Brooklyn named Swami Rudrananda, which is related to the movement center here in Portland.
So there's so much I don't know.
So it's lots of tantra.
Uh-huh.
And it was really good for me at the time because it got me into a practice.
Uh-huh.
But it was very much like, this is just how we do it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and up until that point, like, I was really in my head and not in my practice.
Uh-huh.
And I needed some of that.
Yeah.
And it was really helpful. So the anatomy was pretty good. My anatomy teacher was a physical therapist who saw a lot of yoga injuries in his practice, which I'm very grateful for. Gave me a very good background seeing things in other people, not necessarily feeling things myself. The alignment component was very Iyengar, you know, similar, congruent. When I left Colorado, I didn't have much, you know, there was, in Colorado, I found work very easily because people knew that school, people knew my teachers, they had been, and so then going to Seattle, it was really hard because they were like, where? Ashram? What?
Yeah.
You know.
And Seattleites have a particular disembodied quality.
Yeah, I found my people in Seattle, but it took a bit to get, you know, to that place. But the ashram was good. It was, I needed that at that point.
Yeah.
It's very important to me at this point in my life, like, and in my teaching and practice, not to be a purveyor of bullshit. Like, I very much do not ever, like, I don't tell people this will do this because I have practiced and I have found sometimes that I will be looking through the book and reading, like, here are the benefits, and I'm like, actually, this does the exact opposite thing to me. And so it feels important for me to invite people to have their own experience, which sort of like rubs up against a lot of the more dogmatic schools. And I appreciate, and I'm not saying that they're selling bullshit, but like there's the opportunity is there to just repeat things that we've heard over and over and over and over again, which may or may not be true or correct in this moment. So
There's this Rumi poem, which I have to paraphrase, and I don't even know the name of the poem, but it's about looking for a camel. And it's like, you're looking, this guy has lost his camel, and he's looking for the camel, and so you go along for the ride, basically, and you pretend that you've lost your camel because you just want to be with this guy. So you're like, oh yeah, is that my camel? Is that my camel? But you're really like a fake because you haven't really lost your camel, and you're just pretending you did, and this guy's really looking for his camel. But then one day you see your camel, and you're like, oh shit, I did lose my camel, and there it is. You know, so like to me that really speaks to that pathway of kind of from bullshit to authenticity that we all have. So there's that side of it that I also want to be real about.
Yeah.
And that like that we can't all be real right off the bat. We can't all sustain that. It's too painful. It's like the thing about letting go, let it go, let it go. It's like, no, you might not need to let that go. It might not be wise for you to let that go. You might need to hold that closer.
Yeah.
And I think about like the thing, I agree about the not telling people not to be a purveyor of bullshit, but I try to find a balance because I think it can be helpful to say, this posture has the potential to do this, but it also has the potential to do that. Like to find a way to articulate it in such a way that somebody feels that isn't just going to be trying to be a good student and do the thing, but on the other side, if somebody says to me, this posture can help you find XYZ kind of quietude. Well, maybe it doesn't, but maybe I'm pretending it does, but maybe that leads me there.
Right.
Maybe faking it till I make it is a successful tool.
Mm-hmm.
But anything is a tool and only a tool.
Yeah.
And so how do you, there's no one way to, there's no, like, the tool becomes the problem.
Right. Yeah.
You know.
That, one of my teachers is Eric Schiffman, and
I've never studied with him, but his book was so important
yes.
to me when I was a young teacher.
And so he's, you know, he was very much in, you know, like an Iyengar teacher for a long time, and then the technique started, the tool didn't work anymore. The
mm-hmm.
tool became
impediment.
Yeah, and it needed, the technique needed to fall away. And so there, this is something that I'm like working with on and off in my own teaching. It's sort of like, how do we materialize a tool that, or animate a tool that is necessary without, like, how do we point at the moon without mistaking the finger for the moon?
Good
you
question.
Know, like that's
the whole thing the
yes,
whole time.
Yeah.
Right? Isn't that if you see the Buddha on the road, kill him?
Yeah. Yes.
You know, that's going to be the question forever.
Mm-hmm.
That everything is poison and everything is medicine.
Mm-hmm.
That's one of my favorite.
Oh yeah.
You know, everything without exception.
Mm-hmm.
Everything is poison and everything is medicine.
Yeah.
Yeah. How do you know when the tool is enough? Well, then you have to know, you have to trust your inner self. But you can't trust your inner self when actually what you're arriving at are your prejudices and your fears.
Right. And in the body, it's like, you know, where am I just falling into habitual, you know, patterns that really play to a potential weak point,
mm-hmm.
like, you know, where, like, in places of hypermobility or something
yeah.
like that, where, like, oh, this feels natural, but actually I'm not supporting myself at all. So
yeah.
how do I...
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I feel again and again and again, like, that's about trusting the process
mm-hmm.
and trusting the whole big process. And when I, you know, like when I talk to my friends about either my struggles to make a decision or their struggles to make a decision, right? Big decisions that might involve causing people pain or
mm-hmm.
Discomfort or my own fears or discomforts. And then that desire to sort of just know that something's the right decision or the wrong decision, which is an illusion. So then it's like, well, there's no way you're going to just know it all at once.
Mm-hmm.
So can you relax and trust that the process will take you there, even if your process takes you around behind that big rock and mine takes me around in front of that tree, you know, that it's, you know, so sometimes I'm going to need to drop into a joint while I'm working on something else.
Mm-hmm.
And then I'm ready to see how to not drop into that joint, how to be in the center of that joint and support it from the other joints down. Like, one of the things I really love about working with Todd is that, have you ever worked with him?
No, and every single person I know does.
I just think he's genius.
Yeah.
But not for everybody, you know, like everybody's got their people that they resonate with. But what I love about working with him is that we can be so precise, you know, so precise on something, like he'll have each term, there'll be a set of principles he's working on. And they might be very similar to another set of principles. He's just got a whole different way of framing it,
mm-hmm.
you know, that he's learning from his teacher and that he's working on in his practice. And so we might be doing a posture, say we're doing a warrior one, you know, with the hands at the wall. And all we're working on is how to, you know, right now it's been a lot of, this last term was a lot of like releasing fascial tension from inside the pelvic bowl. So we're working on the release of fascial tension. And then also, then if you can release the fascial tension, then you have to find the deep front line, that support along the inner thighs and all that stuff. And so you might be doing that, but your upper body might be a mess because that's not what we're working on. And so he'll take us all around to show somebody something, like working on somebody. And somebody might say something like, well, what about their upper arm? What's going on there? He's like, we're not working on that right now. Like, let's get this supported. Other times we're working on the whole thing. Mm-hmm. But it's not always. It's not always that we're having to be perfect everywhere.
Right.
You know, and that he builds them, and through a term or through a period of time, he builds it this, then this, then this, then this. Now do them all. But not too soon. Mm-hmm. Not too soon. Not do it all now, but do. Which is, you know, that's an old tried and true method of teaching that really works for me. And I like that quality of, well, so you're not, you know what, well, you're a little collapsed up there, but let's not worry about that. Let's get good there. Mm-hmm. Like, let's really learn this one thing. And then we'll really learn this other thing. We'll really learn this other thing. And then eventually it all just starts to be no thing. It just starts to be feeling your body, mm-hmm. and feeling where you're not collapsed. Mm-hmm. I mean, I'm still, after, you know, 20 years ago, I was in a car accident. I was hit by a car as a pedestrian. I'm only just now understanding really some of the how to balance the scoliosis as a result, or the loose SI joint as a result. But I've been working on it for all that time, for the whole time I've been practicing yoga. I've been trying to work on my, maybe not the whole time, maybe the first few years I didn't have a clue. I was doing all those headstands. But in the beginning it was like, I gotta find the answer to my shoulders. I've gotta find my answer. I've gotta find my answer, and they hurt all the time. And then I had a breakthrough where it was like, oh, maybe I'm just a person who has a shoulder thing. I'm gonna always have this shoulder thing. And then it was like, oh, what a relief. I don't have to be a person who has to fix my shoulder. I can just be a person with a shoulder thing. And then it stopped hurting. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, and then it goes to all these different phases, like, oh wow, now I'm working on my shoulder. And now it's like, actually something's changing. And like, it's that back and forth. It's the, you know, the looping around and the not being all together. It's so complex. It's so delicious.
It is. It's so, one of my other teachers is Kira Ryder, and she is always saying, like, we don't know how anything is going to play out. We're just like the monkey sitting on the tiger's back, watching the tail swing from left to right. Like that, we're seeing things like as we've already walked by. And that is really helpful for me. Like, because like you, like, I've done these things where I'm like, I'll go to law school. Oh, I'll become a yoga teacher. I don't know how I know they're going somewhere, but I don't need to know what that is until it's happening.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah, it's such a relief. It's so, it's for me, it's just extremely painful when I reside in that place of, when I get it together, I'll be a happy person. When I'm different than I am now.
Yeah.
I used to say to my therapist all the time, I used to always talk about like finding balance, and she would say, you know, Sarah, you act as though balance is the opposite of where you are now, but that's actually imbalance over there too. Mm-hmm. You know, you don't have to go so far. Mm-hmm. You can just be just be in balance right now by accepting where you are.
Right.
Mind, it's a big mind blower.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. And hilarious. And, you know, like that's,
yeah. Here we go again.
Here we go again. Oh, I know you.
Whoops.
Where did this come from?
Oh, so this is from this. So it's from China. It came to me in Seattle from this place that I don't think exists anymore. From this, like, the industrial south downtown neighborhood, there's this big warehouse called Moe's. And they,
like, near Pioneer Square?
South of there still.
Oh, God, it's beautiful.
Thanks. We got it the day before the Washington bar exam. It came to us.
It's incredible.
He has a real presence.
Yeah. He deserves his space.
My house in Seattle, so you know Seattle. Like, we just sold that house. So it's pretty much at the corner of 23rd and Union, just south. Mm-hmm. Of 23rd, mm-hmm. of Union on 23rd. Mm-hmm. Pretty rough mm-hmm. neighborhood. Yeah. Like, yeah. People were killed at that corner by guns while I lived there.
Wow.
And and my husband and I were living on foot and on bike, and we lived in that neighborhood, and we were very much a part of it. And I felt like that guy really, like that Buddha really, like there was an energy that was so helpful mm-hmm. to creating a sense of peace there. Mm-hmm. He had a little spot, like just a little nook looking at the front door, and it mm-hmm. felt right. Yeah.
Yeah, they used to always remind us at Karma Choling. There are pictures of great meditators along the walls. That meditation room was created by Chogyam Trungpa. Mm-hmm. And it's just, I don't know if you've ever been to Karma Choling, mm-hmm. but it's an amazing place. Did you ever go to Shambhala Mountain Center?
I didn't.
Well, anyway, the only reason I said that is because Karma Choling, while SMC is like masculine and kind of ferocious, Karma Choling mm-hmm. is feminine and soft, but this meditation hall is like an offshoot, so it's got windows on all sides, and it's bright. You know, the Tibetans do the bright colors and golds and reds and just yellows, and so along the wall were these giant, you know, huge, they were photographs of sculptures of great meditators, and they all had these huge ears because the great meditators are so expert at listening. That was what they kept saying to us. And so that, like, whenever I see these images with the big ears, it's like, oh, yeah. Just so good at listening. Mm-hmm. It's beautiful. Oh, what an experience to live in that kind of a... I mean, I've lived in tough neighborhoods in New York, but that's a different mishmash. It's different... when you're in your own house, you know,
It was interesting. It was, I actually know what's like secondhand crack smoke smells like. Knowing that, breathing that, walking down the street is a very interesting,
it's like that sweet smell.
Yeah. Like almost like burning plastic or something. Yeah. Yeah, it was interesting. It was good for me because I was maybe a little gooey when we moved there, and I needed a little hardening. I needed a little of that. And Seattle is a good spot for that because
there's darkness.
Yeah, you have to be, there's an edge that was, I had to kind of get.
Yeah.
And while we were there, I worried about being too hard. And my husband was like, oh my God, Kelly, Jesus. Like, no, that is not the worry in us. And being back in Portland is good. I don't feel like I'm getting too hard.
Yeah.
But that's always I think that's the work, finding...
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah. Seattle's a great place.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I love Seattle. And for some reason, I just, When I lived there, I lived in New York for 25 years, but I moved twice, once to Seattle for 2 years and once to Hawaii for 2 years. Mm-hmm. And my Seattle stint wasn't my first because we lived there when I was a little kid. Mm-hmm. But I found it, I was in such a different point in my life. I was acting and bartending. But I found it to be cold in a way that was hard. Even mm-hmm. though I had family there, it was hard to find my people. Mm-hmm. And so when I was thinking about moving out again, and my brother and sister both live in Seattle with their families, mm-hmm. my parents live in the Sandwich Islands, I wanted to be near my parents, but I just, Seattle didn't feel like mm-hmm. the place. It felt like I felt like I needed my own town, but mm-hmm. it also felt like, I don't know, I needed softer.
It's I totally resonate with that. I get that. My husband did not make a single friend outside of work the entire time we lived there. Like, we knew people if he had those friends.
Yeah.
And he had work friends. But there is this, like, separation mm-hmm. that I just don't think... Here, people are very, like...
They invite you in.
Oh, my gosh.
They're very polite, but they don't invite you in. Mm-hmm. It takes a long time.
Yeah. And here, I have this whole, like, community that I just met at the coffee shop, like, at Extracto, of people who didn't know me from, like, a hole in the ground, and now I'm friends with all of them.
So you've been here 2 years or longer?
Mm-hmm. Two years.
Yeah.
Yeah. And that would just not happen in Seattle. Yeah. Like...
Yeah. Yeah, no.
With people who are from Seattle. Like, right. Maybe other...
expats.
Yeah.
From other places.
Yeah.
Yeah, I feel that way about Portland. Like, Portland to me is so many people that are so amazing. And, you know, you kind of, like, when you first come to a place, you know, you date around. Mm-hmm. And then there are those people that turn out to be acquaintances, but not really, mm-hmm. or then whatever. And I feel like here there are so many really amazing people mm-hmm. that I just, you know, I couldn't possibly spend time with all the people. But then there's this other thing of like, well, where are my interests taking me? Mm-hmm. And can I just let that, can I ride that mm-hmm. and still be open to these new relationships and new friendships as I'm finding, because it took me a little while to find my, I feel like this year and in finding Renee is when I'm really yeah. finding my people, mm-hmm. my yoga people.
And so when I first came back to teaching, I reached out to Michelle. She offered...
Had you known her? Or
no.
You just
I just sent her an people's... email saying, look, I'm looking to get back into teaching. Yeah. Can I do a demo for you? Something like that. And she just said, do you want this class on Saturday mornings? And it had been Renee at Southeast. And Renee had started teaching. It was Renee's class. And she, I guess, was like trying to concentrate her yeah. life into Northeast or, you know, somewhere at that point. And so Michelle did not know me from a groundhog and... had never seen me teach, except that I have my podcasts and things online, and I think she had looked at a couple of things.
Yeah.
So that's how I just started teaching that one Saturday class. And I was also teaching at Heartfire in St. John's, mm-hmm. which was Michael Faith's studio. And I taught, I think, 3 classes there a week mm-hmm. then. And that's just sort of how I got back into it. It was just but it was, you know, it's interesting because I had never taught in Portland before. Even though I had lived here before and I had practiced here, I hadn't taught here. So there was a whole, like, getting to know people, getting to know, like, mm-hmm. where do I fit? You know, and I would go to all the studios and be like, oh, okay, you know, mm-hmm. this is my place. And... just getting everything sorted out. And I'm still kind of doing that, you know, as we always are. We're always kind of like, okay, this works for now. And and I had this big realization this year where I started to realize, like, you know, before I was always like, oh, I need to get more classes, more people in the door to make this work, like, so that I can contribute to my family financially and make this work. And I had this, like, epiphany this year where, like, whatever I do for the studios, I want to give to them just as much as I'm taking, and have it, like, see myself really as a business owner of my own business, and therefore not rely on the studio to bring anything to me.
Yeah.
And, like, I'm still kind of articulating how I, like, that feels, but like, to show up to them and not expect anything from them, but to give, like, to make it worthwhile for both. And
God, that's just so much more holistic in its approach.
Because, you know, there for a while I was, you know, like, the whole, like, am I an employee? Am I a contractor?
Who's bringing in the students?
Right. And that was that happened in Seattle while I lived there.
Yeah.
We went through that whole thing, and I was sort of, like, tired of that conversation. And so I was just like, okay, I am a business owner.
Yeah.
And I want... like, I want to make money for the studios. Like, we serve different purposes.
Yeah.
And that just happened in the past, like, 6 months, where I mean, and maybe other people have, like, known this for forever, but where I just felt like, oh.
Yeah.
Like, nobody owes me anything, you know? Like,
yeah, it's so, I mean, it's such a, those waters are so muddy.
Yeah, it is true.
You know, I mean, it's really hard. Because there's so much also around, you know, showing up and giving your time. And, but I really appreciate the way you said that. Because it's really, I think I agree with you. It's hard, though, to feel that sometimes, because there's so much of this, because not everybody is... It's like the airplane, you know, not everybody's reclining,
right.
And not everybody's
absolutely
sitting up, and that, like, where the students are going to come from, and who the onus, where that is. And also just having a lot of students versus a little students. Like I remember, you know, feeling that way, like in New York, I was in this very rarefied and probably not existent anymore situation in which the studio had so many classes, it was so thriving, I never had to bring anybody in, I was given privates, I was given work, I was made so much money, and I never had to lift a finger, and in fact, I was discouraged from setting out on my own. Like, it was met with great discouragement. You didn't have, well, it was before anybody really had websites, but then towards the end, it was not cool to be advertising for yourself. It was not cool to be doing your own side things. And so that was, and that suited me because I'm shy about advertising for myself. And then coming out here and going, okay, what do I do? And what do I do with all these people who genuinely are my students and want to know what I'm up to without feeling crass? Like, that's the big discussion Renee and I have been having. It's about our feelings of, like, the aversion to being crass and what that means, as opposed to just, like, really genuinely believing in what you're saying and being out there with it, and then what the relationship is, like, who's dumping on who in the, you know, in the arrangement between the studio. And I think inherent in that is that you be at a place you believe in. Because if you're just, if you're teaching classes at a place that doesn't resonate with you, then it's very difficult to feel, you know, like you're in a symbiotic relationship.
Right. And if you're enthusiastic about what you're doing, like, you know, I find this, like, you know, when at people's, like when I promote, when I'm looking at the sheet of paper, the announcements, and looking, I usually give one little commercial at the beginning of class. And I am genuinely excited about, you know, like what people are doing. And so then like that comes... So it's, and I, even when I'm doing it about myself, where I'm like, oh, I'm super stoked that I have this going on, like, it, there's an alignment there. Like, there's truth in that. And, like, part of why I'm so excited about doing these interviews is, like, after Renee and I talked, and she told me about, like, some moon stuff and how it relates to,
God,
like...
I love it when that stuff comes out with Renee.
Oh my gosh!
Tell me!
And then I'm like, like Kyvalya and the moon and like perspective. And and so then the next day when I go to teach my class and I see Renee's, you know, embodied astrology, Renee and Melina, I'm like, oh my gosh,
exactly.
You guys,
you have to
get your
that.
Butts to this. It's going to be awesome. But there is like, we have like, I feel like so many of us who come into this kind of work, like, we're lovers and givers, and so it feels hard, like if there's judgment around, like, commercials, like, you know, or like, you know, making money or charging or not giving everything away or being excited about something that might also be good for your bank account. But if... you know, if we can use our practice around that and just say, oh, that's just a judgment I have, or that's some residue from something that I have thought in the past.
Like, and also a good way of determining, well, is what I'm doing have integrity?
Yeah, because there will, I mean, certainly there have been things in the past where, like, I've had pressure to do... You know, I worked at a studio where they wanted me to teach a workshop a month, and it, which is hard.
Unless you have a series that,
that you've developed over years, and that very much felt like, oh, okay, here I am, come to my But when it's, you're teaching your practice and you're living that, then it doesn't feel like...
like you're a phony.
This
thing, like, you know, the practice is a practice of generosity, and that you're generous not because you're giving away your last morsel, but you're generous because there's more than enough. And so then it becomes an abundance practice. And it's like, can I see abundance? Can I see how much there is? And then give freely of it, because I don't have to worry about it running out. And I think that that's part of this thing about encouraging other people to do their best, because that grows a community and that grows a student body, as opposed to, I wouldn't want to promote theirs because they might not come to mine, or I don't want to promote because, oh, it feels icky to promote myself. And those are barriers for me to get over, for sure, around the promoting myself. But I totally agree that that process, you know, that's the practice too. It's not like all this is the practice except that gnarly business stuff. You know, it's very much the practice, the business stuff, and how to, like, not be a fool and say, well, this is, you know, there are going to be people that are going to take advantage and exploit, but that doesn't mean I have to close off. I can have good boundaries, and I can be conscious and say, well, it's actually not going to serve you if I, you know, it sometimes serves people more to have to pay more money for something, for instance, you know, and so to set boundaries that allow people, I know that when I've had to come up with money for something, it becomes more important to me, and I have more sense of ownership because I had to make that happen. Whereas if somebody had just been like, oh, you can just have it for free or pay whatever you want. But then sometimes the pay what you want is a great way to go. And it's, you know, like, it's, I think it's like being
everything
fluid.
In its own time. Like, I'm really working now. This year, the practice has been saying no more than I say yes. because, you know, getting to that it, less of or more of anything means less of something else, and just being really intentional.
Yeah.
About
how is it feeling? How's it going?
Good. And it was interesting because there were some people who, you know, I just cannot do that right now, and that feel that's hard. Mm-hmm. But keeping things open and doing it with with love and sweetness. The challenging ones have been like where I've had some people do some shady things in the past, and then them coming back and wanting me, like trying to get me to come back in after I set a really clear boundary. And, you know, even entertaining that for like 1 minute, I was like, wow, I'm thinking about this. Why am I doing that? But being really clear, and even when they keep, like, because they're persistent, and they keep, like, hey, but I really want you here. And, like, that feels great to hear, but not even. Sometimes.
Oh, totally.
So it's been good to be clear about boundaries. And I'm having to do that in a couple of different places that are new to me, you know, where other in the past I would have been like, oh, whatever, I'll just write that off as whatever. But a lot of things that, you know, we're talking about things coming up, a lot of things around communication that were very at the forefront for me like 10 years ago are coming back around, and I'm so different. And it's really fun and interesting to see, like, here's how things have worked. Here's where I still see that I have work to do. And we get so many chances.
And that's with wisdom and discernment. It's like, it's the part of us that doesn't wish we were 20 anymore. Because it's like, oh my God, I understand a thing or two.
Yeah.
Or at least I have experience, you know, in how not to respond. Or the pitfalls of a certain kind of response or the, you know, the... It's really, I'm so grateful. And in some ways I feel like it's a silly thing to say. I'm grateful that I am the way I am. I'm grateful that I live a life that has this kind of texture and that I'm interested in this. Now, a person who isn't the way I am would likely be grateful that they're not the way I am. You know, so that's why it's a little bit foolish to say it, but I'm grateful for it because I love how it works. I mean, I love seeing that I can work on my relationship with my parents without them in it.
Yeah.
You know, that I can actually affect all the change that's necessary within myself. And then have an experience of them that's so loving and so delightful and so appreciative and so, like, not regretful. And that they didn't need to do anything to make that happen. That I could just be the one that does it. That, to me, is incredible.
It's huge. And it's real.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
And that has real, you know, planetary... possibility.
Reverberations.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think so too. Yeah.
Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you. What a fun. So fun. Great. You're good at the interview.
Thank you so much for listening to this interview with Sarah Trelease on the Sunrose Yoga Podcast. Look forward to being with you again soon. Namaste.